Welcome to the Allowed Podcast. I'm Louise Steinman, curator of the Allowed series, presented by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles. Allowed is a series of dynamic lectures, readings, performances, and discussions that take place in the Mark Taper Auditorium at the historic Downtown Central Library in the heart of Los Angeles. To learn more about Allowed and learn how you can help the Library Foundation of Los Angeles support the Los Angeles Public Library, please go to our website, www.alloudla.org. The Allowed program you're about to hear was produced in 2009.
California, the 31st state, formerly known as Mexico, the land of sunshine, as some have come to call it, or alternatively, the end of the Western world, one of the top 10 largest economies in the world, a destination to many, immigrants, would-be movie stars, wannabe cult leaders, and people generally looking to make something of themselves through good old-fashioned hard work. They call us the land of fruits and nuts, but as a third-generation Angeleno and a California native, I say that we're more than that. I think fellow native Californian, yes, much more. I don't know how much more, but slightly more. I think fellow native Californian Mark Arax would agree. In his new book, West of the West, Dreamers, Believers, Builders, and Killers in the Golden State, Mark demonstrates the great cultural depth and diversity of the state. Having spent 4 years exploring California, he recorded the stories of an immigrant family from Oaxaca, located one of the last survivors of the Dust Bowl, and investigated good old Humboldt's dubious claim to fame as the marijuana-growing capital of the United States. In the end, shedding a Joan Didion-like light upon a California well beyond the saturated and eternal sunlight for which the state is known. Award-winning author and journalist Mark Arax is a co-author of The King of California, a Los Angeles Times bestseller, and author of In My Father's Name. He is a contributing writer at Los Angeles Magazine and a former senior writer at the Los Angeles Times. He teaches nonfiction writing at Claremont McKenna College and lives in Fresno. Out-of-towner tonight. In conversation with Mark this evening is Tom Kerwin, staff writer and editor at the Los Angeles Times. Tom was editor of the Outdoors section, a writer for the Features section, and deputy editor of the Book Review. He has been honored by the American Association of Sunday and Features Editors for 3 pieces he did for Outdoors on caving with nature writer Barbara Hurd, on Alaskan bush pilots, and the annual migration of sandhill cranes to the Bosque del Apache. He has a master's degree in creative writing from USC and was a recipient of a 1991 Academy of American Poets Prize. In 2002, he received a Rosalind Carter Fellowship for Mental Health Journalism. This evening's panel will conclude with an audience Q&A. We ask that you please wait for the microphone to come your way as we record for podcast, and we'd also like to just hear what you're asking. Following the panel, you're invited to join us in the lobby where Mark will be signing his new book. Books are on sale courtesy of the library store, with proceeds going to support the Los Angeles Public Library. I'd also like to encourage you to check out the Outer Bridge exhibition on your way out the door. It's really worth checking out if you haven't already. Ladies and gentlemen, please join me in silencing all our cell phones and in welcoming Mark Arax and Tom Kerwin to the Los Angeles Central Library.
How are you all tonight? Monday night in the middle of Easter week, too. It's pretty great.
In the NCAA basketball championships as well.
There we are. Yeah. There we are. Secularist.
Yeah.
Well, welcome. Thank you, Justin. I don't know where you disappeared to, but your comments are always wonderful and quite fulsome. And I also want to sort of repeat his comment about supporting the Library Foundation, that we all have a place to gather on Monday nights such as this, and every night of the week, I think it is, just to gather and hear writers like Mark and other people come up here is just really quite a treat, and I'd suggest that you all do whatever you can to support the organization. You never know what you have until you lose it, and this is something we want to keep for a long while. Well, I'm here tonight, and we're here tonight to talk to Mark Arax. We will open up to questions in about an hour or so, so keep these in mind as we continue with our chat tonight. But we're here to talk about his terrific new book, West of the West, Dreamers, Believers, Builders, and Killers in the Golden State. Gotta love subtitles like that.
Yeah.
I got to know Mark at the LA Times, of course. His writing was something that I always looked forward to in our paper, something that I always sort of aspired to, envied, and thought was really quite remarkable. His words, his gift with words, his storytelling taught me so much about the craft of literary nonfiction that as an editor I'd look at that going, he's got the greatest job in the world and he deserves every part of it. I was disappointed when he left the paper, but I was extremely gratified to be able to see his work appear in Los Angeles Magazine under under Kit Rackliss's great work there and Rick Meyer. And so I'm pleased that I'm able to see his writing in that venue because it's a great long form place for his stories. And I'm even more pleased that he's been able to find the time and the diligence to take the pieces that he's written for Kit and taking the pieces he's written for us at the LA Times, as well as add a number of new ones and shape them and craft them into this anthology of just some of the best pieces of literary journalism I've read under one cover in a long while. It's really a stunning collection that has such a wonderful momentum as you read through it and enjoy each piece along the way. Even if you've read them before, he's done some wonderful things with the old ones, and the new ones are always delightful as well. Justin gave us a brief idea of Mark's background in his biography, but that's like the background that you read on the back of a book jacket in some ways, although it was very wonderfully put, of course. But what I'd like to try to suggest is that, or invite Mark to talk a little bit more about his own background. What I find interesting in reading a book like this is that what informs the intelligence of this book is the sense that there is a writer working through these pages and working through these essays and the topics that he's chosen, trying to find answers in his own life. Mark claims in the introduction that this book is not a memoir, and he doesn't indulge in any sort of very first-person type writing. He keeps a good professional distance with his material. But you have to think that there are a lot of questions inside of his psyche in some manner that he's trying to work out and trying to find some answers to. And I thought that the best way to start the conversation tonight would be to get to Mark talking a little bit about his own background. You may have heard these stories before, but I think they're always worthwhile hearing again. And they have to do with the story about how his family first came here to California, something about his father's story and his father's tragic death, and how he came to be a writer.
Well, I'll start where the book starts, which is my grandfather's journey out of genocide. My grandfather was born John Ig Hosepian in a village about 45 miles outside of Constantinople, Istanbul. And his good fortune was that his mother was a wet nurse and moved from the village to Istanbul. And when the genocide broke out in 1915, the Ottoman Empire, the Turkish gendarmes were kind of careful not to do some major atrocities in the big city where all the European powers could see it. My grandfather hid in an attic for 1 year, and he took up Baudelaire and Verlaine, all these French symbolist poets, and just hid there. And when he came down, he had this idea that he was going to go to the Sorbonne and become a poet. And he went to work at a bookstore in Istanbul called Babikian's Bookstore, and the intellectual Armenians who had not been herded and massacred gathered there again, and they gave him, they said he had to have a pen name. John Ig Hosepian wouldn't do. So the first pen name was Aram Aslan. Now, Aslan means lion. My grandfather was about 5'3", 120 pounds, so he didn't quite conjure the image of a lion. There must have been something about his prose that reminded the masters of the Arax River that flowed down from Mount Ararat, our mother river. And so they gave him the pen name Aram Arax, and that's how he arrived in the United States. He was headed to the Sorbonne. He had an uncle named Ervant Janigian who had lost his whole family in the genocide and landed in Fresno. And Ervant was writing letters to my grandfather telling him about this land in the San Joaquin Valley. You know, grapes as big as jade eggs, watermelons the size of small boats. And my grandfather, you know, here was the Sorbonne and here was Eden, and he chose Eden. He arrived, and Ervant was a wonderful guy. He had a big gleaming Model T Ford picking him up at the Fresno train station there, and he was dressed just impeccably. And my grandfather, I know, he told me, he said that he thought this was going to be easy, this life here in America. And Ervant let him indulge in that for about 3-4 days. And they got into the Model T, and they drove to a place called Weed Patch. And that's where Steinbeck ended up 30, 40 years later. And my grandfather did what all poets do in the San Joaquin Valley. He got on his hands and knees and started picking potatoes. And that was our story here. I went back to the farm. He worked on a farm for a guy named Villa Krikorian. And they called him Villa because he had a big Pancho Villa mustache. And Villa Krikorian was a paper millionaire. And then about 3 years after my grandfather arrived, there was a raisin bust. And he, one by one, Villa Krikorian lost all his land. He had to move off that ranch in Weed Patch and move his family to Los Angeles. During the auction of the land, he came back and he took a hoe and severed the ear of the auctioneer. He was so upset. But he went to L.A., took his family, raised them there. And I like to think he got his good even, because his get even, because his son ended up becoming Kirk Krikorian, one of the wealthiest men, you know, in the world. And the extra tragedy is we're not only losing the land, but beneath that land, they discovered a whole sea of oil. So, you know, he lost a fortune, but then a generation got it back. So these are the stories I grew up with. My grandfather telling me these tales very close to the land. When I went back to do this piece, I went and found that farm where he first started. And in the dust there was a family of Mixtecas from Oaxaca. And they were Trique Indians. And I thought, my gosh, here, you know, they're kind of like two pulses that beat in this state. There's one that's remaking this state as fast as can be. The valley right now really is Los Angeles in the 1950s. They're paving over that land, even with this bust, this real estate bust, they're paving it over and basically putting, you know, subdivisions and mini malls and sprawling in a very LA fashion. So there is that pulse that's remaking the land. And yet there's that pulse that 80 years later continues to draw these migrants with their stories. And they graft their narratives onto the narratives of California. And so there wasn't a whole lot of it didn't take a whole lot of imagination seeing them in that dirt to then see my grandfather 80 years before. So that's kind of how the book begins, with that prologue.
And why don't you give us the next chapter of your life, though, now that we have your father, your grandfather down. Let's talk a little bit about your father, because clearly his fate has affected you in a very profound way.
My grandfather in the 30s became a member of the Communist Party. And part of that was because Armenia became part of the Soviet Union. So his love of Armenia became a love of the Soviet Armenia. But also he felt very strongly about the injustices of America in that time and joined the party. When I was writing my first book, In My Father's Name, my grandfather was in his late 80s, and I had him sign a FOIA request to the FBI for his files. A year passed, 2 years passed, 3 years passed. My grandfather died. And then one day my grandmother called and said, honey, there's a very big box from the Department of Justice that's arrived on our front steps. And it took me a second to think what it was, and I said, Grandma, don't open it, I'll be right over. And you would have thought the FBI would have figured out that my grandfather had died because they'd been following him for 45 years. Every year the FBI in Fresno would write the FBI in Washington and say, do we need to continue to follow this man? And every year Washington would say yes. So I opened it up and much of it was blacked out, but there was some classic, lines in there. He was subject Aram Arax, subversive is what it said at the top. And then there was just 45 years of following him around. I mean, I remember they followed him one point to the Kings River for a Labor Day event. And it said, subject Aram Arax was seen eating a shish kebab sandwich. So I thought it took two FBI agents to figure that out. And then, so this is what it was made up of. So how this man had two capitalists for sons, I don't know. But my father and my uncle started a grocery chain in Fresno where they actually tried to shut out the union. My father was a football and baseball star, went to USC, but the family farm called him back, and so he had to leave. And it was to his great regret because his senior year team went to the Rose Bowl and everything else. So he came back, ran this grocery chain called the Peacock Markets, and then at some point Safeway came in, and we lost those markets one by one. My dad then came home one day and said, I bought a restaurant. And I remember the first time I saw it, I walked in, and it was a long bar and a dance floor and a bandstand. And in the very back, there was this place where an old Armenian man cooked shish kebab and pilaf, so that, I guess, made it a restaurant. But my dad quickly figured out that food was not, you didn't make a good profit margin on food, and so he turned it into the hottest nightclub between L.A. and San Francisco. And I grew up there on Saturdays playing pool. I became quite a little hustler. And the first thing I did when I walked in, I would, on my hands and knees, go under the bar stools because that's where all the money was. Five, tens, twenties, you know, fifties. And scoop it up. And then over time, I started noticing that scattered among the dollars were pills and joints, and I'd pick them up, and Dad would say, there were a lot of reds. For some reason, the San Joaquin Valley was like the Seconal capital of America. You would think the fog would have been a downer enough, but they had to have the reds too. So my dad would say, just flush them down the toilet. My cousin started cleaning up for me. He was 2 years older. He didn't flush them down the toilet. He started pocketing them and selling them at high school. So I actually, in the summer of 1971, Chuck Berry, fresh from a prison after violating the Mann Act for transporting prostitutes across state lines, actually played at our nightclub and duck walked across a stage about half this size. And El Chicano, all these groups. So my dad was mixing it up quite a bit. And behind the bar it was this wonderful blend of socialism and capitalism, and he would talk about, we have to stand by Cesar Chavez and the farm workers and what they're doing, and you know, I just remember it being a crazy mixing up of things, old world, new world. And then one night, a Sunday night, I was going to go to the bar with him. He was going to count some of the New Year's receipts. And he found me in the shower and said, it was very cold and foggy out. And, you know, Armenians say, if you go out with wet hair, you're going to get pneumonia. And so he said, stay in the shower. I'll be back in an hour. And then a phone call came, and my mom started screaming that your father's been shot. And, you know, so that was the beginning of, I guess that was the end kind of my childhood. And not too long after, because this murder was never solved, I picked up a notebook and started keeping notes. And I'd like to think, and I did think, that for a long time, that murder and the mystery of it was the reason I became a journalist. But family members say that I was asking questions long before that. So maybe it was you know, maybe it was meant to be. But it certainly defined my life. I wrote the first book I wrote, I started 17 years after the murder. I moved back, left the LA Times for a few years, moved back to Fresno, and investigated the murder. The question that tugged at me was, who was my father, obviously? Was he the baseball coach and the football coach who cared so much about the community? Or were those rumors true that he had somehow taken a shortcut and all the drug smuggling that was happening in the valley? It became a hub of drug smuggling nationwide for some very simple reasons. The valley was wide open. It had landing strips everywhere in the cotton fields and hay fields. The crop dusters were making maybe $5,000 a year, and in one furtive run to Mexico, they could make 10 grand. And the farmers were having their problems, so the sons of the farmers became smugglers. And the farmers, some of them, started financing these loads. And the first major marijuana and cocaine operations that were smuggling those drugs out of Mexico into America were landing in the San Joaquin Valley, and then the Hell's Angels were transporting it out across the country. And these guys were all hanging in my dad's bar, and I was hustling them on the pool table. They were characters, but at some point my dad felt that what they were doing was ultimately going to destroy our community, and learned that the police department and the sheriffs were protecting this operation, a corruption that went way, way back. I mean, the police chief of Fresno in the 1970s was married to the biggest madam in town. That's how wide open the valley was. The valley, I don't know, you know, you guys drive through it probably on your way to Yosemite, but it really is a place of geographical exile. And because it's been exiled from the rest of the state, it's kind of developed its own code of doing business. It's not accountable to the rest of California. It doesn't feel like the rest of California. And for all those cultures that are there, the culture that kind of dominates, I mean, the Hmong, the Armenians, the Italians, the Serbs, the Volga Germans, the Japanese, but the culture that dominates is the Oki culture. And so the mystery of the murder, why my dad was killed, drove me to do that book. And 30 years after the murder, it was solved, in part because some people had read the book and their conscience got to them and they came forward. So that's a very long telling of that middle chapter of my life.
And I'm learning things that I didn't know before. You were 14 years old when your father
was killed.
Yeah, very impressionable age, of course.
Yeah, it was a very tough age, and I was the oldest in the family. Mm-hmm. And so that made it even more difficult.
And what I find so interesting as you describe those stories is just as reading through West of the West, just finding the various threads picked up, whether it's on the Zankow murders that occurred here in Los Angeles or some of the other stories of the Central Valley. You definitely are playing with a lot of themes in the lives of others that have resonance in your own life.
I think that what I wanted to do with this book, and I was inspired by Joan Didion's Slouching Towards Bethlehem, you know, I think a lot of the folks that have written about California are folks from afar. New Yorkers come, they land, and they all of a sudden start dealing in these tropes, stereotypes about California. And some of the books are very effective. I mean, there was the last one I remember was by Amy Wilentz, you know, I Hear Earthquakes More Often Than They Happen. I think it was the title of it. Mm-hmm. You know, I vowed that I didn't want an earthquake, a mudslide, a wildfire in this book. And even though I had the opportunity to meet Charles Manson at the PHU in Corcoran Prison, and I'll never forget that scene because the swastika was still here, and yet he was wearing Birkenstocks. but I vowed that there would be no cameos of Charles Manson either. So I wanted to get away from all those stereotypes and really dig deep into the earth and tell a story that played with all these voices in this history. So there's memoir I, there's stories that are told third person, there's an essay voice in there, and there's kind of a conflation, you know, me, just all different voices telling the story, however effective I felt it would be. So that was kind of the method.
And as you talked about your father's death, what I found interesting just hearing you now is how the notion of mystery, I mean, you went 30 years with this mystery in your life. And what I find intriguing about this book is that there's no immediate rush for conclusion. There's no neat package with a bow at the end of any of these essays. Each of them close with sort of a wide openness that leaves a sense of mystery intact, which is sort of a credit, I think, to your ability to see that and not push yourself or try to force any sort of artificial ending or anything that's just not true to the inherent raggedness of life.
Well, thanks. I mean, some of the pieces, I mean, you always try to end as strongly as you begin on a piece. Most of these pieces are about 10, 12,000 words. Some of them, there's a piece called Confessions of an Armenian Moonshiner.
It's a wonderful story.
It's really a story of
my
friends, as a way to kind of reach back, we built this still about this tall, and it's the head of it. It looks like this Tin Man on steroids, and we go into the vineyards once a year, and we cook Rocky, moonshine, white lightning, flavored with anise.
And the proof is?
The proof is about 160 the first shot, and then...
It only gets better from there.
Yeah, no, it gets... And then what happens when it weakens, you take that weaken and put it back through again. And I talk about how that batch is something very close to the supernatural. But, so anyhow, that piece is a little shorter. But when I move around, there's a piece called The Last Oki of Lamont. I go back to Lamont where Steinbeck found that camp. And I literally find the last Oki there. And I tell his story as we're driving to a funeral to bury another Oki that died in nearby Bakersfield. And he tells this, you know, this incredible story of growing up in that weed patch camp. So I move it around a lot, and you know, if you don't like one story, you just...
No, you like them all.
Go to the next.
And each builds, I assure you.
I end with my dad's my dad's murder story. It's the epilogue, how it kind of ends up.
There's so many wonderful lines in the book. So just to pick a couple to sort of help you explain them to me and perhaps elucidate a little bit more of the book itself. In one of the essays, and I forget which one, it's in the opening, you write, every writer, and this is sort of a paraphrase of it, every writer who comes from the land must eventually confront a deep ambivalence about the place that nurtured him. A deep ambivalence about the place that nurtured him.
Well, I saw that with Soroyan. I had a chance to know Soroyan growing up. He was a friend of my grandfather's, and he lived in these two side-by-side track houses on the west side of town. And he would go to Paris half the year and then come back to Fresno the other half, right around the time when the ponies were running at the Fresno Fair. And it was a sad... I mean, I remember asking him, this seems lonely, the way you're living, because his wife... He married his wife twice, and I remember him telling me, thank God Walter Matthau has her now. But there was a loneliness, and there was also, when you read his work, there was a great love for the valley and what it gave him, the stories, the migrations, these epic migrations that came through that place. But there was also a deep kind of hate of the place. For it being the way it is, shut off and I think a place that remains deeply, deeply conservative, and a place that has, you know, tremendous problems that they never solved. And so I think he felt that ambivalence. I think Didion, when you read Didion, she talks about that ambivalence. In fact, they ended up fleeing. I ended up leaving for a long time, but then coming back. And I think coming back, you have that immediacy that you have is can be a good thing. I mean, you're living right amid the changes and everything else. But I also think there's a danger that your eye gets fuzzy the closer you get, and I think you I write about, like in this book, I write about folks that are committing crimes in Fresno and their neighbors. You know, they're literally friends of friends, and so it's difficult writing about your place, living in the place. And I think
it's curious to hear you say that, because what I read in this book doesn't betray that at all. You've been back there, I'm guessing, 10 years now.
Yeah, I've been back since actually more than that. I returned first in 1990, so.
Right. And so I guess I'm wondering, I mean, do you still feel an ambivalence towards the land? Or have you, as a journalist, more interested in documenting that ambivalence than actually playing into it or analyzing it in your own self?
Well, I think when I write about Fresno, I have to be careful because I don't want it to sound...
Downtown.
Yeah, no, not just the anger what that place became. You know, I talk a lot about this with my cousin, Aris Janigian, who is a novelist. In fact, his grandfather was Ervant Janigian, the one who brought my grandfather to America. And he is writing about California and the valley in novels. Mm-hmm. In fact, he's got a new novel out called River Big, and it's a gorgeous novel. And what he's doing in fiction, I'm trying to do in nonfiction. But we talk about this because he moved to Los Angeles, and I stayed in Fresno. And our perspectives are different about the place. He comes back every 2 months to work the grape harvest, but then he gets to leave and go to Highland Park, okay? Or Hancock Park, excuse me. Difference. Me, I got to stay in Fresburg. So I don't know. It's I'm still trying to figure the place out. I've been, and probably always will. And
did putting this book together help you come to conclusions that you didn't have before?
I think so. I started with the middle, my familiar turf, and then I worked out to the California's extremes. Mm-hmm. And it was a funny time for me. It's a 4-year period from one election to the next. During that time, my eldest daughter left the house. I lost my job at the LA Times or left for complicated reasons. My marriage went kaput. I mean, it was a weird time. And I felt very, and then I moved into one house and then into a condo, then into a house. So I felt very adrift. And I think this book was my attempt to try to latch onto something. And it was fun hitting the road and going up to Humboldt, for instance. There's an entire, you know, we're talking about dividing California in two. Well, I really think if you want to be true to the place, you probably have to divide it into five because, you know, there are five different states. And Humboldt is a state built wholly on ganja, hemp, marijuana. I mean, everything about that place in a 200-mile range is, you know, has to do with the cultivation of marijuana. And it's just wild. I mean, you know that, but then when you go up there and see it, it's something else.
There's a wonderful moment in the start of this book where Mark paints a picture of himself sitting in his garage with all the boxes of his journalism at the LA Times and elsewhere, standing around or on the floor around him as he starts sort of culling through all his notes. And at this point when, you know, the marriage had fallen apart and his job had gone away at the Times and things of this sort. And he sort of a moment of reckoning when you decided that this is really what you had to do at that point of your life as a writer.
I was looking at those notebooks, and you know, we had, I mean, you know, lives captured on those pages. And you know, a journalist just you do one, and then you leave it behind, and then you do the next story and leave it behind. But there were many stories that I couldn't leave behind. So the first piece is the one piece that kind of moves around a little bit. The rest of them kind of bore in on one family or one place, but that first piece moves. And I thought it would be a nice way just to go back and revisit some of these datelines. And so I go back to Monterey Park, the first suburban Chinatown. My friend Jesse Katz has written a book about Little League. It's coming out in a few months. But it's about love, and it's a memoir, and much of it takes place at a ballpark in Monterey Park. And we used to drive Garvey and Atlantic when that transformation was happening. I mean, literally incredible transformation. So you know, that piece, I go back and just basically say, what happened to these lives? And I went back and 25 years later found these folks. So
and it's what you discovered in that story that sort of helps play out a theme throughout the entire book that you write about in the introduction. You write about, if you dig deep enough into a myth, you'll discover a mirage, a chimera, a poverty, a greed, a hubris, a crime. The lie that was the antithesis of the original myth, which by its very dimension had become a new myth.
Yeah, I mean, I was playing with the myths of California. The myths, obviously. I mean, you know, when you look at our Sierras, our valley, you know, the richest farm belt that man has ever made, our prisons, our Golden Gate, our little Tokyos, our little Armenias. I mean, there's so much big and so much myth about California. And yet when you dig down in any one of those places, you will see that it's pretty messy on the ground and it's be pretty brutal and ugly. I deal with some of that brutality in a piece called The Summer of the Death of Hilario Guzman, where I follow one Indian, Trique Indian family for a year from one raisin harvest to the next. And so that's what I was playing with, the idea that for better and for worse, what we do in we do it bigger in California than anywhere else. Yeah.
And I guess what I find so fascinating about that, I mean we all sort of know that California is the place where dreamers come to try to figure out their lives and hopefully make it big or not or whatever. I mean, this is sort of in the California psyche. And I guess as I was reading this book, I had to wonder why. Why is California west of the West? Why does California attract these sort of hopes and these sort of dreams again and again and again, even when we know that they all ultimately result in some sort of a darker truth?
I asked that very question about the Hmong. The Hmong literally came out of 17th century, you know, Laos, and arrived in Fresno. You know, in a matter of 10 years, there were 50,000 of them. And I was driving yesterday with my brother-in-law. We were driving to a packing house along Highway 99, and we decided to take the back roads. And every little corner, every little patch of small land, an acre or two, was being farmed by the Hmong. And there were white caps over their tomatoes in case of a late season frost. And here they were, you know, a tough, tough life. Grandma, mom, father, son, right there in the fields. And yet something about that land, the rural. You know, one day driving down 99, I looked to the side of the road and I found a tar paper shack that looked like it had been lifted out of the Mississippi Delta. I thought, I didn't think anybody was living there, and yet there was smoke puffing out of the chimney. Actually, it wasn't a chimney, it was like a pipe. And so I drove off into a vineyard and knocked on the door, and I knocked 3 or 4 times, and out came James Dixon, you know, a black man with a stutter and a deep southern drawl. And I said, "Jesus, how long you lived here?" And he said, "More than a half century." And I said, "How did you arrive? Why did you come here?" And he said, "I followed the cotton trail west." And I said, "Well, are there others like you?" And he said, "Yes, across the road, there's a whole settlement." And so I went to this place called Teveston, and there was a settlement of forgotten black Okies. And no one had ever written about the black Okies. And so, the LA Times, what an incredible newspaper. It gave me 2 years to capture these voices, and thank goodness I captured them on tape. But they were a dying generation, and they had done something that no blacks in America had done. That great migration from south went north to the big city and even west to the big city. And yet there were 40,000 blacks from Oklahoma and Arkansas and Louisiana who had some belief in the land, just the land. And they decided to go from rural to rural. And what greeted them was this brutality. They could not live in the cities, so places like Corcoran and Tulare and Visalia locked them out. And so all they had were these little patches of alkali on the outskirts of town. No running water, no sewer lines. And there I found them a half century later. So I went back in that first piece and found they had all died. But the son of one of them had come back to build in Allensworth. Any of you were familiar with Allensworth? It was the first black settlement in the West, and it had dried up because of bad water. And one of these dreamers had come back inspired by Colonel Allensworth, 100 years ago. And he'd come back and bought 700 acres and was going to plant garlic and peppers, and he was going to have Australian rabbits to sell for their meat and also to fertilize the land. And so there's the dream.
I love that image of Mark driving through the Central Valley, seeing this shack with a little smoke coming out of the roof, and just getting out of his car and knocking on the door. I mean, that's great journalism. To play a little bit more about sort of the dark side of the myths and the dreams that California attracts, I think one of your great stories that appeared in LA Magazine first is the story of the Zancal murders here in LA. And there's a point in that story where you talk about the Armenian notion of fate, and P-A-K-H-T.
Pacht.
Thank you. Or Jagadarkir.
Jagadir. Is that Jagadir? Yeah. It means, my mom used to say,
yes. Thank you.
You know, your fate is carved into your forehead. And yeah, the Zancu chicken, I don't know how many of you have been to the Zancu chicken chain, but it had a real tragedy a few years back where the son in his 50s murdered his mother, who had come up with the garlic paste, the magical garlic paste, murdered his sister, and then shot and killed himself. And this was a great amot, a great shame in the Armenian family and community. And there was some interest in journalists kind of documenting that, but no one could quite pierce the family. So I came back in 3-4 years later, and I traded on my Armenian-ness, you know, let's be honest, to get in the front door. I tried to be genuine about it, and I tried not to be, I did a little song and dance on the front steps, but not a whole lot. But I just said, listen, I want to tell this story of this tragedy, and I want to talk about, this was the widow of the man who killed everybody and himself. And she did some thinking, and she said, well, come on in. And I spent a couple months with this family, and I really related to this one son named Stephen, who his father had sent him off that day as he hatched this plan to kill everybody, sent him off to the Glendale Galleria for a lemonade. And when he arrived back, his father, who was dying of cancer, he thought he couldn't get off his bed, but he had dressed up that day in his finest white suit and left before Stephen came back, and went to the house where his mother and his sister lived and shot them. And this son was struggling with the echoes of this 4 or 5 years later, and I saw very much kind of those same questions that I wrestled with.
Right.
And so that's that piece. And even though I don't appear in the piece, there's a sense that there's something else there in that story, that the journalist has some kind of investment beyond his ethnic, you know, the shared ethnic background.
And I guess I found so interesting that notion of one's destiny being etched into your forehead at birth. I mean, sort of flies in the face of what California promises us, and yet is sort of the roots of so many tragedies.
Yeah.
At the heart of that you write about in this book, and that we see wherever we go in this state.
It's hard to figure. The Armenians were the first Christian nation, and yet there's a, you know, Saroyan, I remember him once saying that, you know, we're basically pagans. You know, a lot of our festivals are pagan, and so that. Well, this notion of fate carved into your forehead is something that every Armenian kid learns early on. And in this story, the legend of Zancu, the grandmother, literally in her journey across those killing fields of Anatolia, as she saw the skulls, you know, along the riverbeds and stuff, she actually picked them up to see if there was something carved in the foreheads of the skull. Yeah.
Yeah. And I guess what I find so in this particular story, the way you write about Stephen is so poignant. I mean, you really do get a picture of a man who's sort of trapped between generations,
yeah,
between that sort of wanting to become a new American, an Armenian American, and the family and the past that's behind him, and it also his father's tragic fate and his family's tragic fate. There's a moment where you talk about this sort of anecdote about a raisin stealer.
Yeah, Stephen was a complicated guy. He was listening to Armenian music on one hand, and his favorite movie, which he saw time and again, was Scarface. So there was something in that. The raisin stealer's grandson, I use it because there's I think it happens in every ethnic culture. But I remember a story where I went to an Armenian picnic at the fairgrounds once, and these old ladies were sitting in their aluminum chairs, and their nylons were kind of rolled up to here, and you could see the fat kind of gathered right there. And they were talking, they were pointing to this young kid. He was only 14, 15. And they kept called him the Raisin Stealer's grandson. So somehow this crime that had been committed, you know, grandpa stealing some raisins, had survived, you know, two generations. So he was labeled. And so Stephen, we were talking about this story one night, drinking a little bit, and he wondered, you know, how long is this thing going to follow us? Will my son be known as, you know, the Zonku murder's, you know, grandson? And so, anyhow, that's.
And does that apply to you in your life as being the son of the?
Oh yeah.
Yeah.
Although I've kind of added to it a bit, memorialized it, you know, in a way that, you know, someone who would have run from it didn't. But
and by memorializing it, resolved it in some manner or softened the edges of it a little bit.
I think so. This last piece I wrote about right. it, I think I really put it away. The man, one of the gunmen who killed my father, is in one of the prisons I used to write about. I did the stories about Corcoran Prison and becoming the deadliest prison in America. And this just drove the boss of the corrections union, guards union, crazy. He couldn't figure out how the son of a murdered man was writing stories that were shining a light, on the abuses against murderers. But it, to me, it just made sense. You know, it's what the story was. But where was I going with that?
the fact that you were able to resolve
Well, this guy is in one of these prisons, and he's writing me still. He's saying, you know that it wasn't a robbery, like, you know, I want you to come see me. I will tell you the real story, the one that didn't play out in court. And I've been tempted to do that several times, but he keeps wanting me to send $1,500 to his prisoner account. So I wrote back a letter saying, if this was a robbery, it's the longest running robbery in the history of California. It's 30 years in the making. You know, what he couldn't take from my dad, he's trying to get from me. But
this book is going to draw a lot of associations with Joan Didion's great book, Slouching Towards Bethlehem. But there are certain parts of this book that I'm reading, and I swear I'm with Steinbeck's Harvest Gypsies, his piece of from the 30s of the migrant workers in the Central Valley. And with that, I'd like to invite Mark to read from The Summer and the Death of Hilario Guzman. It's a passage here that is, I found myself reading the book, and then I couldn't help but suddenly start reading it out loud to my wife and because it's really a great passage.
I didn't come prepared to read, but it's swell to do it. And I didn't have my glasses, so I'm going to borrow Tom's.
Somehow it works, too.
Yeah. He's at 175, just like me.
Very distinguished look, too.
Yeah, It's a page and a half or so. This is at the middle section of the story where I'm teamed up with a photographer named Matt Black, who is this incredible photographer who's documenting these stories in images in the Central Valley. I do a piece in the LA Times about a farm worker who died of heat, just working too hard in the heat. And I named the farmer whose land he was working on, a guy named John Giamara, who happens to be a lawyer as well. And he read the piece, and he called me from his vacation spot in Italy and said, I'm not talking to you now as a farmer. I'm calling you as an attorney. When I get back, you better be able to explain every I and T in that story, because when I'm done, I'm going to own you and the Los Angeles Times. He was peeved that I had referred to grape picking as one of the most brutal jobs in America. What are you trying to write? He shouted. The grapes of wrath? And so this begins this passage. That's the context for it. A few days later, Matt Black and I boarded an old church bus at 4 a.m. and barreled into the heart of the barrio. Behind the wheel was Humberto Mota, a labor contractor in a white cowboy hat who played middleman between coyote and raisin grower. It was Mota who had given Hilario Guzman his job and helped raise a few $100 to send his body back home. Now, a week after the funeral, Mota had 90 minutes to pick up a busload of workers in southeast Fresno and deliver them to a vineyard in Fowler. Past the El Sombrero Bar and the Tequila Nightclub, he drove under a crescent moon, the stereo blasting Mexico cowboy crooner Vicente Fernandez. Each time El Rey hit a high note, a panel of jerry-built lights at the front of the bus came on like a Christmas display. It was a strange piece of accessory, given the odds that anyone would be in the mood for a ranchera music light show at 5 a.m. For Mota, it might as well have been high noon, the way he floored the big diesel through the dark and quiet streets, stopping with a screech at the entrance of each apartment complex. If the rumble didn't wake them, his horn did. Out they came, blurry-eyed, in groups of 2, 3, and 4, lugging gallon jugs of fruit punch and orange juice in buckets filled with burritos. Except for one boyfriend and girlfriend couple, the women took seats in the front and the men in the back. Under the sweat-stained hats of the New York Yankees, the Texas Longhorns, the Michigan Wolverines, they tried to find sleep again. The drive, like everything else, didn't come free. Mota charged $3 one way, $6 round trip. His route, full of zigzags and backtracks, made no sense except that it conferred great privilege on those he picked up last. What these workers must have paid him for that extra hour of slumber. It was 5:30 a.m. by the time he emerged onto Highway 99 and headed past the golden domes of a Sikh temple. Only in the shooting headlights of the big rigs did their faces become visible. All were young, except for one man with gray hair. By Mota's count, they ranged in age from 18 to 60. 15 had come from Puebla, 7 from Oaxaca, 4 from Michoacán, 3 from Guerrero, the rest from Sinaloa and Veracruz. Inside this one bus were 6 of the Indian languages of Mexico. One man spoke in the tongue of the Aztecs. They had left villages of slash-and-burn farming for the most technologically advanced agricultural in the world, a leap of 150 years. Yet in the raisin fields of Fowler, a town built wholly on the wrinkled grape, the work could not have been more primitive. They attacked the quarter-mile rows at first light as if struck by some frenzy. Into the vine's thick curtain, they dove on hands and knees, gnats flying in faces and sulfur dust choking their lungs. Had a stranger come upon the field just then, he would have seen the vines shaking violently, but by what sustained force, he wouldn't be able to tell. Not until he walked right in, bent low, and stuck his nostrils in the ferment, would he know that it was a farm worker, no more than 5.5 feet tall, slashing inside the green canopy. Baked earth, dried leaves, black widow webs, and mildewed berries stuck to the sugar juice splattered on his skin. He said his name was Hilario Mendoza, and he was 18 years old and 6 months removed from his village in Oaxaca, where the land, he said, had gone dead from over-farming. He already knew the difference between picking table grapes, a job that places a premium on aesthetics, and this mad snapping of amber bunches that he let plop into a bucket below, a job that cared only about speed. When the tub was filled with 40 pounds of Thompson grapes, He carried it from the vine to the middle row and spread out the bunches on a piece of butcher paper, the tray. The row had been sloped so that the high end caught the sun at its strongest, and if the sun turned to rain, the drops would trickle off the bunches and slide down until the silky powder of dust. It took 18 days of valley sun to blister a grape into a raisin.
Yeah. That's what I'm talking about. That's good. That's good. I love that detail of the vines shaking and not knowing what's there till you're upon them.
It's a weird deal. You see them, they're just, you know, then you got to crawl underneath and join them.
The reporting in that particular story is so strong. There's a moment where you actually have the nerve to ask somebody if you can look inside the refrigerator.
Yeah.
It's a great instinct. What were you... Tell about the reporting of that story.
Well, this family was... The father was basically making about $2.50 an hour when you added in gas and everything else, and they were eating. I mean, they had just some beans and some tortillas. And I remember the mother telling me that she had a choice between diapers and chicken, and she chose diapers. So at one point, the father was gone, and you know, I just decided that you know. That this was kind of cruelty to come visit and not try to offer up something to ease this. I mean, it's a dilemma for a writer, a journalist. Do you go in and change the condition that you're trying to document? And yet, you know, your humanity always wins out, I think. So I asked to look in the refrigerator, and it was bare. The only thing that was there were some watermelons that the young boy... had stolen from the patch down the way. And so I remember gathering them in the car and taking them to the store, and I remember she came up to me and she said, "It's chicken and diapers." And I said, "Get them both, you know, take them both." And, you know, that was that. But it was, it was a lot of on-the-ground stuff that, and the difficulty was that I don't speak Spanish, and she didn't speak Spanish, and she spoke Trique. So it took that little boy to translate, you know, those worlds.
This book raises so many great questions, and I'm looking at the clock. I have two more questions to ask, and we'll hopefully get through those efficiently. So I'll give you a chance to start thinking of your own questions for Mark here before we head out into the lobby for the book signing where you can talk to him personally. In that story about the moon shining and the moonshine and your copper still, you write about no longer being able to afford the entanglements that come with being an Armenian in America.
Well, I think my whole professional career at the LA Times, I wasn't the Armenian reporter. I was... just happened to be Armenian, you know, writing on the Chinese and the prisons and the Hmong and the Latinos. And when you're part of an ethnic community, there were only five Armenians at the newspaper. And about the only time we got together is when the paper would make the mistake, which it did with some frequency. It would say the alleged Armenian genocide. And we'd get together and protest that and say there's nothing alleged about it. And at some point, our talking about that got them to change the style book to say that there's no equivocation when it comes to the Armenian genocide. But that was about it. That was about it for Armenian activism. I mean, the same way that a Latino reporter doesn't want to always be assigned to cover the border, or Chinese, you know, covering something. You know, I think there's some strengths that you bring to it. Maybe if you speak the language, it helps you. But the community... Like any small community, it wants to constrain you, you know, and you can easily fall into its politics and everything else. So I decided, even though, my grandfather was an Armenian priest and the other one was the commie, I decided that I was going to become an American journalist. And only now am I coming back to to some of those Armenian themes, and I think that's what the moonshine's all about. That and just getting, you know, liquored up once in a while. Yeah, one of my we made 7 leaders. We, you know, we try to do this in the fog because the revenue agents can discover what we're doing at any time. But I think that's the entanglements I'm talking about. Just, you know, that you're expected to do things for the community, and hopefully the community will mature to a certain point and not require that of its, you know.
And I think that's an interesting dilemma that I think a lot of second and third generation immigrants to this country do face,
yeah,
as they try to find their own way, and maybe it's a blessing or a curse that you're trying to find your own way in a place like California with the illusion that the whole world is wide open to you.
Yeah, I think that's true.
Possibilities. You have a final line in the book that's such a great line. It's and I wonder if you could just talk about the where this came from. That you write. And this goes to my admiration of this book, and it's sort of, you know, I mean, what was it Keats who wrote about being able to live with mysteries in the world, that negative capability? And Mark writes, "In the absence of answers, love the question."
I can't lay claim to that. That's Rilke.
Yes,
I stole.
But you brought it to our attention. So
yeah, no. that's my dad's deal. I mean. At the end of that story, there's always digging. I mean, I got a call not that long ago from someone saying, "Hey, there's a new source who's got some incredible information about your father's murder." And I'll take down the number and the name and just put it on the corner of my desk where it accumulates dust and, you know, a little guilt maybe. I think at some point even if I went to see this guy, I mean, there's nothing more that he could give me that I already found out. So I think we end on the questions. We begin with the questions, and I think we always end with questions. And that's not too profound, but that's how it is.
And sort of a nice segue to questions.
Yeah, that's what it was about, transitions.
That's right. That's the only thing good journalists do is make transitions between the facts, yeah. If we're lucky. So, a show of hands or for the questions for Mark, please.
Who's brave? Yes.
I have a question.
Wait for the mic, right behind you there.
Okay, thank you. I'm curious about the person that you found out may have or did kill your father. When you found it out, did you look back and as a teenager until, you know, 30 years later, did you ever encounter that person in Fresno?
No. The two shooters came out of Detroit, so I never knew them. Now, the first time I saw the guy was in a courtroom.
And my second question is, the fellow that was murdered at Zanku, did you find out the reason why he killed?
It's a very complicated story, deep inside an Armenian family. The simple answer is that he was dying of cancer, and during this time of great need, his mother disowned him, even though she was living in the same house he was in. It's much more complicated than that. It's about mothers and fathers and some greed and betrayal.
It's the complication of that which makes that such a great story, where Mark lives with the mystery. There really is no clear answer except that sort of knot of emotion that Mark covers.
That's it.
I see questions back there. I don't know if the mic's working.
Thank you. This is kind of two-part and vague. You said that that Armenia was the first Christian nation. I wonder if you could say just a little bit briefly about how did that happen? Was it Paul? And also, for many years, I've heard that the Jews and the Armenians are like cousins.
We're the lost tribe.
Okay, and I wondered if you could say a little bit about that historically or mythically, if you know. Thank you.
301 AD, I learned it in Sunday school. We were the first Christian nation. I don't know much beyond that. I don't know. Even though my grandfather's a priest, I have to plead ignorance as to how that happened, but we were. As a nation, we decided to become a Christian nation. So as far as our linkage with our brothers, the Jews, I mean, it's a very interesting relationship, very complex. I have a uncle, Danny Melnick, and he married my father's sister. And I swear those kids walk with a certain lean forward. They've got so much weight on their shoulders, you know, Holocaust, genocide. But every time Armenians get together, we talk about how we don't have our act together like the Jews. I mean, can't we get it together? You know, these are people that support themselves, each other. And they're able to do this and that, and we're divided up. Everything in our community is divided up into threes and fours, and why can't we be like them? And how come we're not running Hollywood? And you know, this is what it is. So, there's a lot of competition. The Armenians, I think, Armenian men have. If I can make a general statement, their tempers are more fierce than Jewish men. Okay, I guess. Yes, but the kids, the kids grow up both sides with a kind of sense of being princes. There's Armenian princes and Jewish princes and princesses as well. There's a lot of similarities. And they say that there is actually a tribe of men known as Armenian Jew. And you look at them, and I don't know what it is. And the story is that in Bitlis, Bitlis, in the far eastern Anatolia, that was the Armenians known as Beatles, Bitlisis. And Saroyan was a Bitlisi. The story was always that the Bitlisis are Armenian Jews. And that's why they were the smartest of the Armenians. And yeah, there's a lot of interesting stuff and some rivalry, because here's the deal. Jewish scholars have done more than any other group other than Armenians to advance the scholarship of the Armenian genocide. They've done incredible work. And yet the mainstream Jewish organizations, the Anti-Defamation League, JINSA and others, are working hand in hand with Turkey every year to deny the Armenian genocide. And there is a real argument going on right now in the Jewish community as to how that can be. You know, the idea that never again wasn't just never again for Jews, it was for everybody. And so there is a fight in the Jewish community right now, an argument that's playing out in some of the Jewish press again this year. So it's an interesting deal that I think deserves to be written about.
We have a lot more questions. Why don't we go to over this side, that gentleman there, please.
My first experience with Armenian contact was here in Los Angeles, and he knew a lot of British history. He was going on about the Treaty of San Stefano, the way the Brits didn't, you know, back down. He really liked Disraeli, but he was also angry at the end of the British Empire too. And I wonder whether you got some insight into that Armenian relationship to the British community, both here locally and also in England, because I know Guggenheim and all these sort of...
I don't know much about that. I know that Toynbee, right, was British, and I know that he documented a lot of the Armenian genocide as it was happening, so there was a great deal of admiration for him. There was Wilson was it the 14 points or the 13 points, and one of them was Armenia as a nation, and I know that there were some things that happened with Britain where Armenians felt that they caved in on some things to Turkey, and there was this idea that we needed to forget that war and what happened out of it. But I don't know any particulars about the relationship. I imagine my cousin would or someone else, but I don't.
Why don't we go to this lady over here?
Thank you. You mentioned Humboldt as one part of five parts that you define of California. Could you explain the other four?
Yeah, there's Humboldt, there's the Central Valley, the San Joaquin Valley, there's the coast, there's Los Angeles, and then there's the border. Wow. That borderland is, I mean, the border, and there's a Volman book coming out that I'm reading right now. I mean, it's this Volman guy. It's about this thick. It's called Imperial, and it's just a window into the border in America through Imperial County. It's an incredible work of excavation, obsession. The guy's crazy with it, but he spent 10 years documenting this thing. So I think those are the five. A couple more questions.
How about way off in that far corner in the dark?
And I'm assuming that's William Volman that did Europa.
William Volman. Yeah.
You mentioned the 2 years you spent at the Times on one of your stories, and back when the Times was really the Times. And I wonder what you think the future of investigative journalism can be when there's nothing to support it like that anymore.
Well, you're looking at one of the last of the literary journalists at the Los Angeles Times right here.
Good question, and thank you, Mark.
Yeah,
and is your pink slip in the mail?
These guys... You know, I was asking Tom about this last series he's written. I haven't picked up the paper in the last couple of days, but he's written this series. And in the old days, it might have been five parts, and each part was, 200 inches. We believed the reader was going to read all that, and I think maybe they did. But it's a lot shorter now, but he's still doing it, and there's still a few folks that are. And I don't know where it's going to end. I know my sense is the internet is not friendly to long-form narrative nonfiction.
But it's interesting. That said, the two-part story that ran yesterday and today, we've had more than a million hits on that story as of this afternoon. So long-form and internets, we're happy to break the rules and try to push it in different directions. But
hits.
But your point's taken. Yeah.
No. I want to believe that hits are reads. But I will tell you that there was a story. I mentioned this. There's a story. It was about shaved ice. And this story went, when the newspaper picked it up, there was a Fresno Bee, that they couldn't believe how many hits had come. There were thousands and thousands of people hitting on shaved ice. Well, it had nothing to do with snow cones. Let me tell you, it had to do with shaved. You can, you guys can... fill in the rest, but it was it had to do with Britney Spears and Paris Hilton. So anyhow, it's so are those were I don't know if people read the stories or if they're so now in his case it was the story, but some of these hits thing and we're all chasing hits and I don't know where it's taken us, and I apologize for that last story deeply.
Okay, I'm being told two more questions. I see a hand right there.
That's my cousin.
The novelist.
The novelist. It's probably going to fill us in on the British Army question.
When you were backstage and were being kindly introduced, the gentleman mentioned that you were from Fresno, and there was kind of a chuckle in the audience.
I was going to ask about that. What's the vibe with Fresno?
But that's very... almost a predictable response whenever you mention you're from Fresno or living in Fresno. But I wonder if you might say a word about that chuckle. And what is, we know a lot about what's terrible about it, but what's so special about it that both keeps you there and makes it such a, important part of the state?
I think the chuckle begins with Johnny Carson, because he had a standard joke about Fresno. Okay, it's the land of raisins. I mean, we produce more milk and meth than any region in the country. It's easy to poke fun at, and I think it's we've overtaken L.A. now as the smog capital of the country. You drive through it, and unfortunately, the worst. Face of 99 in Fresno, we show the worst part of us to everybody traveling down 99. It's all industrial yards and rust and fast food. So there's a lot to chuckle at. But there's an incredible life there. I mean, I have this garden in my backyard. It goes 8 months out of the year. It's organic.
Watermelons the size of boats?
Yeah. Watermelons are tough because you got it. They get kind of funny shaped if you don't water them just precisely right, and I haven't figured them out. But I figured out tomatoes and peppers and eggplants, and it's just this bounty. And the sun, there's something beautiful about that sun. And at night in the summer when it's right, the breeze, it's a coolness that you can use T-shirt weather. You're outside and you're smoking a cheap cigar, and it's a wonderful place, but it has to do with the land, and it's small enough where within the core people know each other. They know their paths. I had a book party at my house on Saturday. You know, I think 400 people showed up. We sold, you know, like 400 books in over two. So there's family and everything's close by, but it is a place that is very parochial, and there's a chauvinism about things there. So I don't know if that answers it.
And I think a lot of rural spots in America suffer
Hicksville.
That fate.
Yeah.
Unwarranted, I believe. One more, or do we have one more? How about the gentleman up there then, please?
You said you followed the people from Oaxaca. What has changed in 50 years when your grandfather came here to do the same thing that these people are now doing? And I mean, is it the dreams that have changed, the promises?
No, that's a beautiful question. The dreams are the same. The promise is different. My grandfather, after 4 years of working with his brother and his mother and his sister, was able to pull enough money to buy a 20-acre vineyard in a little place called Kerman. That is not possible anymore. I don't care how hardworking that Oaxacan family is. I don't care that they crowd 15 people into one bedroom and that they save like, you know, no one else saves. It is not possible anymore to work your way from farm worker to farmer, not in that way. And that's what's changed.
But the dream remains.
Yeah, it's the same dream. But, and that's, I think, the brutality of the place.
Thank you, Mark.
Thank you, this has been wonderful.
Great.
Aloud Audio is presented by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles and made possible through support provided by the Ralph M. Parsons Foundation, the Annenberg Foundation, City National Bank, contributors to the Stay Home and Read a Book Ball, and Donna and Martin J. Wolf. Media support provided by KUSC 91.5 FM and KCET. Aloud theme composed by Larry Karish.